Okay, so I'm going to start with a poem by Kabir. Don't go outside your house to see flowers, my friend. Don't bother with that excursion. Inside your body, there are flowers. One flower has 1,000 petals. That will do for a place to sit. Sitting there, you will have a glimpse of beauty. Inside the body and out of it, before gardens and after gardens. So, I'm going to be talking this evening about Amitabha. And Amitabha is the red meditating Buddha of the Western realm. He's just round there. Well, he's not literally just round there, but the image of him is round there. And if you look at the image, you'll see that he's still and calm and vibrant. And if you look at that image, actually, when the candlelight goes down, it will start to kind of pulsate with life. He's a fascinating, I think, very fascinating figure, and attractive and full of love. And I'm going to read you a description of my teacher, Sangharakshita's, experience of him while meditating in a cave in India. And this is partly to set the scene, to kind of evoke Amitabha, but it's also because it's Sangharakshita's own experience, and I think nothing beats real experience. So that's why I'm going to read this. And in the description, the gesture of Amitabha is slightly different to in this image. So in the description, he's holding a flower, but it's the same figure. And the reading's from a book called The Rainbow Road. One night, I found myself, as it were, out of the body, and in the presence of Amitabha, the Buddha of infinite light, who presides over the western quarter of the universe. The colour of the Buddha was a deep, rich, luminous red, like that of rubies, though at the same time, soft and glowing, like the light of the setting sun. While his left hand rested on his lap, the fingers of his right hand held up by the stalk a single red lotus in full bloom, and he sat in the usual cross-legged posture on an enormous red lotus that floated on the surface of the sea. To the left, immediately beneath the raised right arm of the Buddha, was the red hemisphere of the setting sun, its reflection glittering golden across the waters. How long the experience lasted, I do not know, for I seemed to be out of time as well as out of the body, but I saw the Buddha as clearly as I had ever seen anything under the ordinary circumstances of my life. Indeed, far more clearly and vividly. The rich red colour of Amitabha himself, as well as the two red lotuses and the setting sun, made a particularly deep impression on me. It was more wonderful, more vivid, more appealing than any earthly red. It was like red light, but so soft as to be altogether without parallel. The experience itself never faded, and nearly a quarter of a century later, the figure of the Buddha is as clear to me in reflection or recollection as it was the next morning. So, Amitabha is an archetypal Buddha. We've been talking quite a lot about the imaginal and the archetypal Buddhas. And really, Amitabha communicates through his being the depth of the Buddha Shakyamuni's meditation. The Buddha meditating is the central image of Buddhism, arising out of the crucial experience of the Buddha's attainment of enlightenment while seated in deep meditation under the Bodhi tree. And if we look at the life of the Buddha and the suttas, there are numerous references to meditation. Before his enlightenment, when he was exhausted, And the Buddha to be, Siddhartha. He'd exhausted all his kind of ascetic practices in his quest for truth and freedom. And he kind of asks himself, well, is there another way? Might there be another way? And what comes to him is a memory of himself, sitting under the cool shade of a rose apple tree when he was a boy, watching his father ploughing and being absorbed, contented, and enjoying the pleasure born of solitude. And he spontaneously entered meditative concentration and sat there all day, absorbed and happy. And this memory is a turning point for Siddhartha. It gives him a clue. It illustrates the importance of remembering. He hadn't forced anything. It was completely natural. And it leads to a recognition that this is the way to enlightenment. So he abandons the practices he's been doing. He starts to eat food. And he decides to sit under the Bodhi tree. So we have a tree on the shrine above the Buddha. But the Bodhi tree on the night of the Buddha's enlightenment was quite different, because the Buddha's enlightenment happened in May, around spring. So you can imagine there were beautiful green heart-shaped leaves that were above the Buddha. And it was said that even the leaves were totally still, and they glistened as the Buddha sat under the Bodhi tree. It's also said that all animals and birds remained quiet. We had quite a few animals, well, mainly horses last week, actually, so even the horses would have been quiet if there'd been any around the Buddha at that time. And interestingly, apparently when the Buddha sat under the Bodhi tree, he faced west. He faced west into the setting sun and towards the ocean. And that's very interesting when we think about the symbolism of Amitabha. And he's the only Buddha, Amitabha, who sits on a lotus on the ocean. So the Buddha sits serenely, the Buddha-to-be sits serenely, even though the forces of Mara, and we've talked a little bit about Mara, Mara's kind of like delusion, you could say, or sometimes even known as death, really. Even though the forces of Mara rage around him, Mara hurtles all these things, javelins, spears, all manner of weapons. But as they reach the Buddha, you know, there's this aura of flowers, and they turn into flowers, really, by touching his aura. So there's this lovely sense of this meditating, peaceful form that can just transform anything, really. And the Buddha keeps on meditating, whatever happens. Mara sends in his daughters, who I think are called something like Lust and probably, I can't remember the other one, but they've got some funny names, his daughters. Anyway, he sends them in, and the Buddha doesn't even glance at them. He just carries on meditating. And the Buddha sat for apparently 7 days after his awakening, which I think really suggests the depth of his absorption. And during this time, there was a kind of pre-monsoon storm that blew up. And as the sky darkened, another figure appeared, also from the depths, interestingly. There's lots of images from the depths, really. This figure was Muchalinda, who was a kind of serpent stroke naga. And he arose from a lake nearby, and he wound his coils around the Buddha 7 times and then protected him, like with a sort of hood, if you like, as this storm blew up. And nagas, we mentioned this last week, that nagas are from the depths of the ocean, and they like protect the Perfection of Wisdom, which is a book that's supposed to be at the bottom of the ocean. And Yanavacha was also mentioning trees this morning, and And I, on my way to the shrine room, I'd been really looking at that little tree, you know, that is quite small and it's got all these spreading branches. And I was kind of imagining myself sitting under that tree this morning. And I felt, yeah, I did have this sense of a sort of shelter and this sense of coming home. Oh, and that's the title of my talk, by the way, Coming Home. I forgot to say that. So what I was thinking as well was when the Buddha opened his eyes after he'd gained enlightenment, he actually is supposed to have sat gazing, unblinking at the tree for quite a long time, this tree that had protected him, this tree that had sheltered him. And it was like he really reverenced the tree. And I find that really beautiful, that he reverenced this tree. And one thing the Buddha did say is that one suffers if one lives without reverence. That's quite a strong thing to say. So he reverenced the tree. And then later, he reverenced the Dharma, the truth that he discovered. And, you know, he did that as he taught it. So after his enlightenment experience, the Buddha did hesitate about communicating his experience. He wondered if people would be able to understand. But then someone else appeared and encouraged him to teach, a figure called Brahma Sahampati. And the Buddha's response to him is really the action of the compassion that had awakened in him as part of his enlightenment experience. It's like the compassion that he felt impelled him in a way to teach, to share, or to try and share what he had discovered. So he had a kind of visionary response, you could say, which came from something that he would have seen quite often, probably in his daily life. It was a vision of lotuses. And lotus pools are very common in India. Anyone who's travelled to India will know that you do see lotus pools, you know, in quite dry, arid ground often. You suddenly come across them and it's like, wow, you know, they're a real symbol of life and colour. And so the Buddha's vision was a vision of humanity as lotuses. And they weren't just any old lotuses. Some of them were blue Utpala lotuses. And these are very special lotuses that only bloom at midnight. So they're very, very beautiful, very exquisite perfume, and very rare. He also saw red lotuses, rich red lotuses. And he saw luminous white lotuses. And I think this is such a suggestive and kind of evocative and all-embracing, inclusive image about our potential as human beings. It's just so beautiful, this image of us all as lotuses and us all unfolding in a way. It's like the Buddha really saw our uniqueness. No one, and I really mean no one, was excluded from that. He saw that everyone had that potential. He saw that people were in different stages of life and growth, and we can appreciate that on a retreat like this. You know, we're all different, we're at different stages of our life, but we're also all learning from each other. In spite of maybe age differences, cultural differences, all kinds of things. We learn from each other. And we all need the conditions in which to open and blossom. And by coming on this retreat, you're really putting yourself in those conditions. You're putting yourself in the conditions to encourage your own unfolding. And I've seen this unfolding happening already in the first 5 days of the retreat. I sometimes think we should take photos when you all arrive and then take photos when you leave and give you the photos and you'd see just yourselves. Sometimes we can't quite see it ourselves, how we change, how we open. And sometimes I think this sort of image of unfolding, it can seem like it's a slow, imperceptible process. And sometimes it is. Other times it's like, you know, just these petals just unfurl and open in such a sort of quick way. I remember on a retreat I was on quite a number of years ago now, at a retreat centre called Rivendell, and there were some evening primroses in the garden, and quite a few of us went out into the garden one evening, and we just saw these flowers just open. They opened really quickly. Apparently evening primroses don't open or bloom for very long, and I had never seen them before. So it was like seeing, you know, a David Attenborough planet Earth flower just unfurling before our eyes. And just seeing that sometimes that unfolding is so quick, it isn't always a slow process. So it's very beautiful, and then every night after that we used to go and look at the evening primroses. It became our very own nightly nature program. So the Buddha didn't always meditate alone. There are some beautiful descriptions of him and his disciples sitting and meditating together, sometimes in very large numbers. At the start of the Samanatthala Sutta, we come across such a scene. It's a full moon night. We've got a little crescent moon, but we haven't got a full moon, but anyway, we've got the beginnings. And a full moon night's very auspicious. So it's a full moon night. We're in India. Just take yourselves there. There's a king called Ajatasattu. And he's heard that the Buddha's in the forest. And he wants to meet him. So he decides to have his 500 elephants saddled up and to ride with his entourage into the forest to see if he can find the Buddha. It's quite a long way, and the king's not in a very good state of mind. He's beset by all sorts of fears, and this is because he's murdered his father to gain the throne. At last, though, after quite a long time of going through the darkness, they come to this clearing, and they come to see the Buddha seated in meditation with 1,250 monks. All of them are perfectly concentrated, perfectly still, and spread out before him like a vast, clear lake. The silence, the sutra says, touches and fills the king with a nameless dread because of what he has done. The hairs on his neck stand up on end, but he's also moved by being the presence of the Buddha and his followers. He's moved by their collective meditation, their collective stillness. And on the spot he asks to become a disciple of the Buddha. I'm not going to tell you what else happens in the sutta. You'll have to read it to find out. But what strikes me in this description is the image of the Buddha and his disciples as this vast, clear lake. It communicates something of the stillness, the depth, the clarity, and the vastness of meditation. The expansive, open-ended limitlessness. And something of the mysteriousness of that as well. And by being on this retreat and by sitting here together, we too can have a sense of ourselves spreading out from the Buddha on the shrine, like a vast, clear lake. Imagine, maybe around 11 o'clock tomorrow, when all of you are in here meditating silently, trying to keep really, really still. Imagine if someone walked in from the school. What effect would we have on them, I wonder? They probably wouldn't expect to find us all in here silently meditating. So we would all be contributing to that stillness. And we can all try and be like a pool of stillness. And we can all support each other in that. And all those pools of stillness will create this vast lake that comes from this Buddha. And in a way, by having a central shrine, we've kind of created this lake around the Buddha. And if you think of a vast lake, you can only really get a sense of its depth through its stillness. You don't get the sense of depth when it's choppy or moving about. You get a sense of depth by stillness. So Amitabha, the Red Buddha, is the Buddha of meditation. He's also the Buddha of love and compassion. And as we've heard, he's a deep red colour, and he glows with extraordinary light. And he rests on a deep red lotus on a still, calm sea, made of pure shimmering light, deep red and yet tranquil. It's a vibrant stillness, a deep, warm, alive stillness that's free-flowing, and it can have a resonant presence in each moment of life. He also has an oceanic depth of awareness and feeling, a radiant awareness that is like a great ocean of metta, which has a warm centre of love at his heart. So again, there's this image of the deep, the depths, communicated through him sitting on this ocean. So what is meditation? What is the Buddha's advice about how to meditate? For this talk, in a way, I'm going to talk a bit about some of the things that the Buddha says about mindfulness and metta, because they're the two practices that we're learning and exploring on this retreat. So the Buddha talks quite a lot about present moment awareness, about mindfulness, and how it's of great fruit and great benefit. Once he was asked what his followers should tell people who asked about what he was doing in the forest, he replied, "Tell them that I dwell in concentration on and present moment awareness of the breath." We can imagine their response. Is that it? Maybe there was a kind of incomprehension, that what was being said was not seemingly very profound. Elsewhere, though, he says of his enlightenment, "Unremitting mindfulness was established. My body was tranquil and untroubled. My mind concentrated and unified." And we all know from our own experience how very hard that is to do. We're all learning that through coming and learning to meditate. It sounds very easy, doesn't it, to stay with your breath, to stay with this present moment awareness, but it's actually really difficult. So if we look more closely, we can see it's actually quite profound what the Buddha's saying. Because whatever happened, he simply observed his experience without adding anything on, without interpreting it or getting caught in reactions to it. And this was the practice that he then came to call mindfulness. It wasn't that, you know, there was this practice and he was doing it. It's more, he did this practice and then he came to call it mindfulness. And sometimes past experiences and the residues they had left on the heart resurfaced. And that can happen for us, can't it? Residues of things, you know, from our lives come up in meditation. And sometimes he found himself thinking about the future or things around him. But he learned to notice, observe, and be sensitive to the emotions that were kind of underneath that. And he saw his experience as a flow of mental states, one developing out of another. He saw the patterning of his thoughts I really like that. He saw the patterns. Again, it's such a creative, rich image. You know, we could just think our thoughts are just these endless things, you know, and sometimes they are, aren't they? But we can also see these beautiful patterns. I remember on one retreat, I felt like my thoughts were like on this conveyor belt, which to begin with was quite small. It was going round and round. But as the retreat progressed, it was like the conveyor belt got bigger and bigger. I mean, I still got some of the same thoughts coming round, but I expanded a bit to have a bigger conveyor belt. So the Buddha also saw that how, well, in a way, some states, you know, that are associated more with craving and hatred carried more of a sort of compulsive power that grew stronger if he dwelt on it. He also saw the suffering they created for himself and for others. And he saw how to stop sowing those seeds and causing further suffering. And other states like friendliness, kindness and love could be nurtured if he paid attention to them. And that's something that you'll be learning, those of you that haven't learnt the Metta Bhavana yet, you'll be learning that tomorrow. It's what you focus on grows. Whatever we dwell on, whatever we keep thinking about, becomes the inclination of our awareness. It's really important to remember that. So we need a sensitive, kindly awareness that can kind of allow whatever's there, but also help us to respond to it with kindness and let it be there, but not dwell on it in a way that, you know, sets up a story or a narrative. So mindfulness and metta are inextricably linked. In a way, it isn't really only the mindfulness of breathing. On one course I led, someone called it the kindfulness of breathing. So it's mindfulness and it's kindfulness. Because you need kindness and sensitivity to be aware, and you need awareness to be kind. The Buddha's kindness was based on a direct seeing of what was needed in any situation. Interestingly, at the end of his life, his friend and companion, Ananda, referred to him not as he who was so wise, he who was such a brilliant teacher, he who was so energetic. All the qualities he could have mentioned, and he'd spent a lot of time with Ananda, with the Buddha, very close up. He said, he who was so kind. And I've also been thinking a little bit about awareness, in the sense of, well, the precepts we've been chanting every day, and just reminding myself that it's mindfulness clear and radiant. So again, to me, this brings mindfulness and metta really together. It's this sense of clarity, but also radiance. So there's quite a lot of suttas that are connected with mindfulness, and it's a bit like they're blueprints in a way for how to practice, and they start with mindfulness of breathing, the practice that we're doing here. And they go right up to mindfulness as an enlightenment factor, because mindfulness is supposed to have been, you know, the practice, as I said, that the Buddha was doing, although he didn't call it that until later. And mindfulness is the key to the whole path. And now here's a good cooking metaphor for you. I was very pleased when I found this. The Buddha said, just as salt is useful in preparing food, mindfulness is always useful at every stage and whatever is happening. So I particularly like that, as you can imagine, especially as I've been using Cornish sea salt in the kitchen, which gives me, you know, this sense of the Amitabha connection as well, because it's from the ocean. So, the mindfulness of breathing is a way as well of us establishing a connection with the breath, which you all know, and we can directly experience that all the time. And this in turn can lead us to a broader awareness of the body. fact, we first come into contact with the body through the breath, but then we can extend that to an awareness of the body walking, an awareness of just moving around in the world, whatever we're doing. And when we're on this retreat, you know, the whole retreat is an opportunity to practice being aware, being mindful. We can do this when we're walking to the shrine room, chopping vegetables in the kitchen, making tea, washing up, cleaning. When we're doing all the things we're engaged with in the work period, we're trying to be as present as possible, really doing what we are doing. So when we're washing up, we're really washing up. Our minds aren't elsewhere. We're not washing up to get on to the next thing or so we can go on that walk. We're just trying to just do the washing up. And when we're able to do this, our experience of anything that we do becomes more vivid. It becomes more engaging and it has a richness to it. The washing up starts to flow. I've seen it happening already. It's like a dance. It's just beautiful to watch. There's a beauty in the way a team works, doing the washing up. It's been happening in the kitchen too, when people come and help us chop. There's a flow about it. It's like what could be a chore, chopping vegetables for 90 people, you know, becomes like a dance. And, you know, it really reminds me of my years in Wild Cherry that Subhadramati was mentioning. You know, I did have this sense of well, when we were really in tune, that it was like a dance. And it became more like play. And you're able to just move effortlessly from one thing to another, going up a gear when you need to. Because mindfulness isn't about being slow. I just want to make sure you know that. Not about being slow. It's an engaged, awake, alert state of mind. I think mindfulness also helps us to relish things, relishing life, getting absorbed in what you're doing, not just in meditation, but, you know, just encouraging. I just want to encourage you to relish things on this retreat. And we've already had this poem, but I'm going to read two lines of it anyway, but the poet Rumi sums this up by saying, "We'll let the beauty we love be what we do. There are hundreds of ways to kneel and kiss the ground." And I was remembering this kind of, this vivid awareness as well on another retreat. I was remembering having an experience one evening after a ritual. It was on a summer retreat. And I was sitting near, it was in a school not quite as big as this. I was sitting near a pond, a small pond. But my awareness after the ritual had been really kind of, well, it was just, I was much more awake and life was more vivid and everything seemed different, that kind of experience. And I felt like I was living in a Zen poem. The small pond in my experience in this poem became more like a deep lake, which was still and vibrant. And my experience of something quite ordinary became luminous and more profound. So I thought I would read you just one Zen poem, just to give you a taste of what that might have been like. Donald Hall, in a poetry anthology called Being Human, says a poem is a human inside talking to a human inside. And I think Zen poetry talks to the human inside in a very simple, pure and direct way, on the surface, but with a profound inner feeling. So my favourite Zen poet is Ryokan, and this poem's called The Poem of Early Fall. After a night of rain, water covers the village path. This morning the thick grass by my hut is cool. In the window, distant mountains, the colour of blue-green jade. Outside, a river flows like shimmering silk. Under a cliff near my hut, I wash out my sore ear with pure spring water. In the trees, cicadas recite their fall verse. I had prepared my robe and staff for a walk, but the quiet beauty keeps me here. So look for the quiet beauty that keeps you here. Look for the little pauses in your day when you look at the sky and you just have a sense of the quiet beauty. Because, in the words of another Buddhist, Andrew Alensky, each moment of consciousness is a precious gift. Awareness itself is the primary currency of the human condition, and as such it is inherently of immense value and needs to be spent wisely. So to be fully present in life, to be fully aware, fully awake to the very experience of being would be how a Buddha would live all the time. It wouldn't be an effort. The Buddha talks about the four foundations of mindfulness as our natural habitat. And when he says foundations, it suggests something static, but it's much more dynamic than that, because the foundations of mindfulness are our body and our feelings, our mind, and well, the content of our mind, really. So they're much more sort of dynamic, really. And he says that these are our natural habitat. And it's just something about that that really makes me think of, again, this thing of like coming home to our natural habitat. So, we've talked a little bit, or I've talked a little bit about the breath and the body. I'm just going to talk a little bit about Vedana, which is something we've been talking about on the first half of the retreat. What does this mean? Well, it's like the texture of our lives, really. It's that texture that's pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, somewhere in between. And often, you know, we aren't present enough to notice. But a retreat is a real opportunity to slow down and become receptive to the ordinary pleasures of things like peeling an orange, seeing the light on the breakfast table through the marmalade jar, looking at the stars, enjoying the taste of fresh dill, and watching the flight of birds. Nothing special in a way, but richer when our minds are calm and alert and undivided. The kind of consciousness the practices we are learning are helping to foster. There's also more space to experience the unpleasant Vedana without reacting, without adding on to it. The Buddha's image is of painful feeling that is like an arrow that goes into our eye. So it is pretty painful. But then what we do is often shoot another one. So his remedy is lots of awareness, lots of doses of awareness. Then there's also the neutral Vedana. You know, often our experience isn't as strong as pleasant or unpleasant. It's somewhere in between. You know, people often ask, how are you? And we say, well, you know, okay-ish or okay, or, you know, it's a nothing special kind of response. But I think sometimes, if we look a bit deeper, those neutral feelings, we can have other experiences going on there. The very ordinary experiences can surprise us. I don't know if any of you have ever done the raisin experiment, but I was amazed by being on a course that I wasn't leading, actually someone else was leading, and they gave us all a raisin to try. And I think if you'd have asked me at the beginning what my Vedana or response to the raisin would be, I would say, well, neutral, you know, it's just a raisin, isn't it, you know. And also I would probably not have eaten one on its own, much more, you know, a few handfuls at a time, not really paid much attention to the raisin. But I was amazed by all the subtleties and nuances that I experienced as I explored this raisin through my senses. It's like, you know, just this burst of flavour, the texture of the raisin. Just by looking at it, smelling it, sensing it, it was just amazing, really. And I was amazed at the amount of pleasure you could get from eating a raisin. Okay, I'm going to cut a bit of my talk because time is marching on. Okay, so I'm just going to go back here now. Okay. So yeah, so Vedana, come back to Vedana, come back to the body. You know, when you find yourself going off in stories, in your head, come back, come back. One of the images that the Buddha offers for the mind is of a water jug. And if it's half full of water, Mara can gain access. This happens when one senses the world with half of one's available awareness and thinks about it with the other half. But if the water jug is full to the brim, Mara can't get in. So our conscious awareness would then be fully engaged, but with direct sense experience rather than mental narrative. So by filling our awareness with the direct experience of our senses, we empty the mind, and then we can have a sense of peace. And then we can start to investigate the Dharma, really reflect on it. So as well as mindfulness, the Buddha talks quite a lot about metta and bhavana, cultivation. And he uses the image of the mind as a field. And I really like this sense of this field that can always be sowed. You can always plough a field, however fallow it is, however many stones are in it. You can always do it. As long as you've got the skills, you can dig it again. You might have to do some spade work, but you can do it. And I was very struck recently when I was on a solitary retreat at Vedrasana, because all of the fields surrounding the retreat centre had been ploughed. So there were these huge, big clods of brown earth. And I really enjoyed just seeing these brown clods, the richness of the brown, the kind of earthy, fertile field that was just waiting in a way. And I thought, my mind potentially is like that. You know, I can keep putting new seeds in it, I can encourage seeds to grow. So I really, really like that image for the metta. And the metta bhavana is very much about trying to cultivate loving kindness, trying to encourage seeds to grow, really, in the field of our awareness. And again, that starts with these four foundations of mindfulness. The four places: our body, our feelings, our mind, and what's in our mind, and how we respond to those. And that creates our world. And love, or metta, is also said to be, according to Maitreya Bandhu, the ripening of awareness, which I really like. That's from his book, Life with Full Attention. And I'd really recommend that course, actually, if you get a chance to do it. Really good. And the book's very good as well. This ripening of awareness. I really have this sense through the metta of something ripening, or the possibility of something ripening. And, you know, being on a retreat with this amount of people, there are lots of opportunities to practice metta. Plenty of people to put in all the stages. And if, you know, you find that you just love everyone on the retreat, well, there's a whole world out there, isn't there? So there's always someone to put in the metta bhavana. In fact, I think the more you do the practice, well, not the more you do it, but maybe the longer you do it, in some ways, you can see there's a little queue forming of people that perhaps you need to, you know, have a look at. It's quite interesting. So I really want to emphasise mindfulness and metta and meditation is about coming home to ourselves. And I think if we practice mindfulness and metta, then we can come home to ourselves. And there's a real relief when we do that. And when I was on holiday in Cornwall recently with my partner, we listened to Wind in the Willows read by Alan Bates, which was quite delightful. Alan Bates is fantastic. The Wind in the Willows is this children's book, and it's got four main characters. I never read it as a child, but the characters are the badger, Mr. Badger, a toad, a mole and a rat. And, there's this lovely passage in the book where, which I think communicates the importance of this sense of home. The mole has been out with the rat, and he's kind of, you know, he hasn't been home for a while, he's been staying with the rat, but they go on this journey to meet the badger and all these other things happen. Anyway, they walk home, and the mole walks past his old home with his friend, and, well, it goes that the call was clear and the summons plain. He goes back and he beams all the objects so dear to him. There's a joy and contentment with the familiar and friendly things that had long been a part of him. It was plain and simple how much such anchorage meant and the special value of this in one's existence. It could be counted upon to give the same simple welcome. And I was thinking it's the same for us. Often people say they have an experience of coming home to themselves when they learn to meditate. The breath provides that simple anchorage. It's always there for us to connect with. It's the thread that runs through our lives from the day we're born until the day we die. It's like a faithful companion who accompanies us wherever we go. So how does Amitabha help with all this as well? What can we learn from him? Or what does he point to or communicate? Well, the fact that he's meditating, going within, suggests this coming home to ourselves, coming home to our experience through mindfulness, through metta. And the fact that he's red makes it very attractive, because the colour red is so attractive. It's the colour of fascination, passion and love. It's also the colour of blood, which suggests that this going within is crucial to our lives. So Amitabha's wisdom is discriminating. So he can discriminate and see the uniqueness of everything that makes each person who they are, each blade of grass what it is. So Amitabha transforms any limited love that we might feel for just, you know, one or two or three people into a kind of limitless, all-embracive, inclusive love. So anyone can build a house of wood and bricks, but the Buddha taught that that sort of home is not our real home. A Thai teacher called Achan Chah says our real home is inner peace, and I think this peace is what we find by practicing mindfulness and metta and dwelling in those practices. If we don't dwell in them, it's like we're this aimless traveller out on the road going this way and that way. There's a sense of being ill at ease wherever we're going, and only when we really get home can we experience that sense of peace and ease. So Amitabha belongs to the lotus family. He sits on an enormous red lotus, which represents the unfolding, more receptive aspect of enlightenment. He's like an island of love and awareness. And an island is one of the metaphors for enlightenment. This points to the flowers we will experience if we learn to stay within, the seeds that will grow from the field of our awareness, nourished by our mindfulness and metta, into a rich array of colourful, open and robust blooms. Don't go outside your house to see flowers, my friend. Don't bother with that excursion. Inside your body there are flowers. One flower has 1,000 petals. That will do for a place to sit. Sitting there, you will have a glimpse of beauty inside the body and out of it, before gardens and after gardens.